both foreign and domestic, continuing to travel through the country, appearing in person and on television and radio. Finally, in late September and October, he engaged in a precedent-setting series of TV debates with his Republican opponent. These meetings were four in number, and each candidate had the opportunity to set forth his ideas before over 100 million Americans. They covered virtually every topic of importance. And in debate number two, produced by NBC on October 7th, Mr. Kennedy made this point, among others.
There is a very strong moral basis for this concept of equality before the law. Not only equality before the law, but also equality of opportunity. We are in a very difficult time. We need all the talent we can get. We sit on a conspicuous stage. We are a goldfish bowl before the world. We have to practice what we preach. We set a very high standard for ourselves. The communists do not. They set a low standard of materialism. We preach in the Declaration of Independence and in the Constitution, in the statement of our greatest leaders, we preach very high standards. And if we're not going to be charged before the world with hypocrisy, we have to meet those standards. I believe the President of the United States should indicate that.
Even before becoming president, John F. Kennedy indicated his feelings in the area of civil rights. On the 24th of October, the Reverend Martin Luther King had been convicted and sentenced to 4 months hard labor for his part in a sit-in demonstration in Atlanta, Georgia. When it was brought to Senator Kennedy's attention that there was concern for the Reverend King's safety, he at once called Mrs. King, who at the time was expecting a child, to reassure her. Mrs. King recalled that incident for us.
I remember quite vividly when the call came in, one of his aides said, "Mrs. King, just a minute for Senator Kennedy." And of course, it was only a brief minute before he came to the phone and he said, "Mrs. King, this is Senator Kennedy. How are you?" And I understand that, he said, "I am concerned about your husband. I understand that you are expecting a child, and I just wanted you to know that we are very much concerned about his welfare, and if there's anything I can do to help, I'll be glad to do so." And of course, I thanked him and said that I hoped that he would do anything possible for his release. It was a brief conversation, but he assured me at that time that he was concerned not only about my husband's welfare, but my own welfare.
The publicity which followed this call, as well as a subsequent appeal by the candidate's brother Robert for the release of Reverend King on bail pending appeal, succeeded in their aims and were forerunners of some of the actions which were to be taken in later years. Only a few days were left now in the grueling campaign, and from one of the men who was among John Kennedy's earliest supporters, we received this recollection. He's Senator Abraham Rebikoff of Connecticut, who at the time was governor of the state. And he told us,
"There are many incidents that stand out in my mind in my relationship with President Kennedy. But one that is most interesting and maybe significant now was a Saturday before election 1960. We had been campaigning together in New York and Long Island, and were then headed into my own state of Connecticut. It was late, and we landed at the Bridgeport Airport. We started from Bridgeport down through the Naugatuck Valley to Waterbury. The crowds were massive and enthusiastic. And then we got to Waterbury. It was close to 3 o'clock in the morning, and for about 4 hours, some 40,000 people were massed in the Waterbury Green. The president spoke. He was tired. The crowd could not contain their enthusiasm. They kept asking him to come back and speak some more. He then said to me, 'Abe, why don't you speak for a while?' And I did, and the crowd still kept on cheering, 'More, more, more, Jack.' So when he came back, he had this to say, 'I will close by telling you of a letter which Lincoln wrote in a campaign very much like this 100 years ago when the issues were the same. He wrote to a friend, "I know there is a God, and I know he hates injustice. I see the storm coming, and I know his hand is in it. But if he has a place and a part for me, I believe that I am ready. Now, 100 years later, when the issue is still freedom or slavery, we know there is a God, and we know he hates injustice. We see the storm coming, and we know his hand is in it. But if he has a place and a part for me, I believe that we are ready. Thank you. The crowd cheered, lingered on, and about 4 o'clock in the morning, the president, to be, got a few hours sleep.
3 days later, it was all over. The wearying travel, the endless talking and shaking of hands, the strategy meetings, only too soon to be replaced by the even more endless labors that burden a chief executive. But for the time being, on the afternoon of November 9th, the mood was one of satisfaction, of cheerful anticipation, despite the realistic appraisal of the perils that could befall the nation. John Fitzgerald Kennedy had been elected 35th President of the United States, and he had this to say to his fellow citizens.
May I say, in addition to all citizens of this country, Democrats, Independents, Republicans, regardless of how they may have voted, that it is a satisfying moment to me, and I want to express my appreciation to all of them and to Mr. Nixon personally. I particularly want to thank all those who worked so long and so hard in this campaign on our behalf and who were generous to me in my visits throughout the country and who were generous enough to support me in the election on yesterday. To all Americans, I say that the next 4 years are going to be difficult and challenging years for us all. The election may have been a close one, but I think that there is general agreement by all of our citizens that a supreme national effort will be needed in the years ahead to move this country safely through the 1960s. I ask your help in this effort, and I can assure you that every degree of mind and spirit that I possess will be devoted to the long-range interests of the United States and to the cause of freedom around the world. So now my wife and I prepare for a new administration and for a new baby. Thank you.
The new baby, John Fitzgerald Kennedy Jr., arrived on November 25th, and the happy president-elect turned his full concentration on the affairs of state that were to come under his care less than 2 months later. Inaugural day, January 20th, 1961, and with it an innovation. For the first time, a poet participated in the ceremonies. Robert Frost, America's most beloved poet, wrote a poem especially for the occasion, a poem prophetically entitled, The Gift Outright. And shielding his eyes from the glare of the lights, he read them to his president.
The land was ours before we were the land's. She was our land more than 100 years before we were her people. She was ours in Massachusetts and Virginia, but we were England's, still colonials, possessing what we still were unpossessed by. Possessed by what we now no more possessed. Something we were withholding made us weak until we found out that it was ourselves we were withholding from our land of living and forthwith found salvation in surrender. Such as we were, we gave ourselves outright. The deed of gift was many deeds of war to the land vaguely realizing westward. But still unstoried, artless, unenhanced, such as she was, such as she would become, has become, and for this occasion, let me change that to what she will become. And this poem, what I was leading up to, was a dedication of the poem to the president-elect.
Then, bareheaded, his hand on a Bible, John F. Kennedy took the oath of office, administered by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Earl Warren.
You, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, do solemnly swear.
I, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, do solemnly swear.
That you will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
And will, to the best of your ability.
And will, to the best of my ability.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help you God.
So help me God.
John Fitzgerald Kennedy was now President of the United States, elected leader of 180 million Americans. And in his inaugural speech, which followed, he rallied his countrymen with a challenge that will long be remembered. You will recognize the stirring words as he uttered them near the end of his speech on that cold January day.
I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man. Finally, whether you are citizens of America or citizens of the world, ask of us here the same high standards of strength and sacrifice, which we ask of you. With a good conscience, our only sure reward, with history the final judge of our deeds, let us go forth to lead the land we love, asking his blessing and his help, but knowing that here on earth, God's work must truly be our own.
Ten days later, in the Senate chamber, where he had spent many years as the senator from Massachusetts, President Kennedy restated that challenge before a joint session of the Congress. He first set forth what he considered were the major problems facing the nation, and what he hoped could be done to solve them. And then ended with this appeal.
Let it be clear that this administration recognizes the value of dissent and daring, that we greet healthy controversy as the hallmark of healthy change. Let the public service be a proud and lively career, and let every man and woman who works in any area of our national government, in any branch, at any level, be able to say with pride and with honor in future years, I serve the United States government in that hour of our nation's need. For only with complete dedication by us all to the national interest can we bring our country through the troubled years that lie ahead. Our problems are critical. The tide is unfavorable. The news will be worse before it is better. And while hoping and working for the best, we should prepare ourselves now for the worst. We cannot escape our dangers. Neither must we let them drive us into panic or narrow isolation. In many areas of the world where the balance of power already rests with our adversaries, the forces of freedom are sharply divided. It is one of the ironies of our time that the techniques of a harsh and repressive system should be able to instill discipline and ardor in its servants, while the blessings of liberty have too often stood for privilege, materialism, and a life of ease. But I have a different view of liberty. Life in 1961 will not be easy, wishing it, predicting it, even asking for it, will not make it so. There will be further setbacks before the tide is turned, but turn it we must. The hopes of all mankind rest upon us, not simply upon those of us in this chamber, but upon the peasant in Laos, the fisherman in Nigeria, the exile from Cuba, the spirit that moves every man and nation who shares our hope for freedom and the future. And in the final analysis, they rest most of all upon the pride and perseverance of our fellow citizens of the great republic. In the words of a great president, whose birthday we honor today, closing his final State of the Union message 16 years ago, we pray that we may be worthy of the unlimited opportunities that God has given us.
Life, President Kennedy said in his first State of the Union address on January the 30th, 1961, life in 1961, he said, will not be easy. No, life would not be easy. Not too hard, perhaps, for most Americans, but very hard for the millions of peoples living in the underdeveloped countries of the world. The people who knew mostly poverty and disease and hunger. The people who had no freedom except, perhaps, the freedom to die at an early age. No, life for them was not easy. And so help for them was one of the first objectives of President Kennedy and the course he had set toward a new frontier. And so on March 1st, 1961, he announced the establishment of an army of civilian soldiers, the youth of America, who would wage war against illiteracy and the ravages of ignorance and poverty. The youth of America who would carry the war into dark and distant corners.
I have today signed an executive order providing for the establishment of a Peace Corps on a temporary pilot basis. I'm also sending to Congress a message opposing authorization of a permanent Peace Corps. This corps will be a pool of trained men and women sent overseas by the United States government or through private institutions and organizations to help foreign countries meet their urgent needs for skilled manpower. It is our hope to have between 500 to 1,000 people in the field by the end of this year. We will send Americans abroad who are qualified to do a job. We will send those abroad who are committed to the concept which motivates the Peace Corps. It will not be easy. None of the men and women will be paid a salary. They will live at the same level as the citizens of the country which they're sent to, doing the same work, eating the same food, speaking the same language. We're going to put particular emphasis on those men and women who have skills in teaching, agriculture, and in health. I'm hopeful that it will be a source of satisfaction to Americans and a contribution to world peace.
Yes, the 35th President of the United States declared war. War against ignorance and poverty and backwardness. And the Peace Corps was his army, our army. But more than just a Peace Corps was needed by our neighbors to the south, the nations of Latin America. And so on March the 13th, 1961, John Fitzgerald Kennedy acted.
Let us once again transform the American continent into a vast crucible of revolutionary ideas and efforts, a tribute to the power of the creative energies of free men and women, an example to all the world that liberty and progress walk hand in hand.
And so the Alliance for Progress was launched on its way to the new frontier, by the new frontier. But how did it fare? Was it on the right course? Listen to what President Kennedy had to say in his second State of the Union message, delivered to the Congress on the 11th of January, 1962.
The Alliance for Progress is being rapidly transformed
from proposal to program. Last month in Latin America, I saw for myself the quickening of hope, the revival of confidence, the new trust in our country among workers and farmers, as well as diplomats. We have pledged our help in speeding their economic, educational, and social progress. The Latin American republics have, in turn, pledged a new and strenuous effort of self-help and self-reform.
The Alliance for Progress was on the right course back then in January of 1962. But a year earlier, you'll recall, President Kennedy, in his first State of the Union address, had said that there will be further setbacks before the tide has turned. And the first such setback came in a Cuban harbor that the whole world knows now as the Bay of Pigs. The prestige of the United States was on the rise throughout the free world, on the rise because of such things as the Peace Corps and the Alliance for Progress. But a short month later, in April of 1961, a courageous, ill-advised band of Cuban exiles had attempted to regain their home island from a man named Fidel Castro. They made the try because President Kennedy did not say no. Instead, he took the word of his new and, for him, untested advisors in the Pentagon and in the State Department and in the CIA. But to use the words of NBC's Sander Vanocur in the book Memo to JFK, he had been snowed by the experts. Instead of overthrowing the dictator, Castro, 1,113 Cuban freedom fighters were taken prisoners, captives in their homeland. And President Kennedy told the nation,
"On that unhappy island, as in so many other arenas of the contest for freedom, the news has grown worse instead of better. I have emphasized before that this was a struggle of Cuban patriots against a Cuban dictator. While we could not be expected to hide our sympathies, we made it repeatedly clear that the armed forces of this country would not intervene in any way. Any unilateral American intervention, in the absence of an external attack upon ourselves or an ally, would have been contrary to our traditions and to our international obligations. But let the record show that our restraint is not inexhaustible. Should it ever appear that the inter-American doctrine of non-interference merely conceals or excuses a policy of non-action, if the nations of this hemisphere should fail to meet their commitments against outside communist penetration, then I want it clearly understood that this government will not hesitate in meeting its primary obligations, which are to the security of our nation."
That was in April of 1961. United States prestige could not have been much lower, nor could President Kennedy's. But the times and their pressures could not stand still, nor would they stand still while he licked his wounds. But even if they would, he was not a man to sulk. He was a man of action. He spoke with words that all could understand. His kind of language was the kind that all could and did understand. And so he went to Vienna in June of 1961 to talk to a man who also wanted to talk to him. That man's name?
I went to Vienna to meet the leader of the Soviet Union, Mr. Khrushchev. For 2 days, we met in sober, intensive conversation. And I believe it is my obligation to the people, to the Congress, and to our allies to report on those conversations candidly and publicly. Mr. Khrushchev and I had a very full and frank exchange of views on the major issues that now divide our two countries. I will tell you now that it was a very sober 2 days. There was no discourtesy, no loss of tempers, no threats or ultimatums by either side. No advantage or concession was either gained or given. No major decision was either planned or taken. No spectacular progress
was either achieved or pretended. No new aims were stated in private that have not been stated in public on either side. The gap between us was not, in such a short period, materially reduced, but at least the channels of communication were opened more fully. At least the chances of a dangerous misjudgment on either side should now be less. And at least the man on whose decisions the peace in part depends have agreed to remain in contact. This is important, for neither of us tried to merely please the other, to agree merely to be agreeable, to say what the other wanted to hear. And just as our judicial system relies on witnesses appearing in court and on cross-examination, instead of hearsay testimony or affidavits on paper, so too was this direct give and take of immeasurable value in making clear and precise what we considered to be vital. For the facts of the matter are that the Soviets and ourselves give wholly different meanings to the same words, war, peace, democracy, and popular will.
President Kennedy, you might say, was our conscience. From the day of his inauguration, even before, he had told us how we ought to live, how we ought to be, how we ought to let others live, how, when they ask, how we ought to help others live. But from almost the first day of his administration, there was crisis, one atop the other. And in August of 1961, when John Kennedy had been president only 8 months, the crisis was in Berlin, where the communists built a wall. The president talked about it in January 1962 in his State of the Union message.
The threat to the brave city of Berlin remains. In these last 6 months, the Allies have made it unmistakably clear that our presence in Berlin, our free access thereto, and the freedom of 2 million West Berliners would not be surrendered, either to force or through appeasement. And to maintain those rights and obligations, we are prepared to talk when appropriate and to fight if necessary.
If there was one thing that set the theme for President Kennedy and all that he did, that one thing was peace. Peace because he knew the horrors of war, particularly the horror of nuclear war. Have weapons, yes, but have more than that too, far more. A forum where men could speak, man to man, people to people, nation to nation.
Arms alone are not enough to keep the peace. It must be kept by men. Our instrument and our hope is the United Nations, and I see little merit in the impatience of those who would abandon this imperfect world instrument because they dislike our imperfect world. For the troubles of a world organization merely reflect the troubles of the world itself. And if the organization is weakened, these troubles can only increase. We may not always agree with every detailed action taken by every officer of the United Nations or with every voting majority, but as an institution, it should have in the future, as it has had in the past since its inception, no stronger or more faithful member than the United States of America.
President Kennedy was a man who wanted peace, but he was a man who would not run from a fight. He was not a man who would look for a fight, but he was a man who could thrive, a man who could blossom on strife. Hear him again in his 1962 State of the Union address.
A year ago, in assuming the task of the presidency, I said that few generations in all history had been granted the role of being the great defender of freedom in its hour of maximum danger. This is our good fortune, and I welcome it now, as I did a year ago.
For it is the fate of this generation, of you in the Congress, and of me as president, to live with a struggle we did not start, in a world we did not make. But the pressures of life are not always distributed by choice. And while no nation has ever faced such a challenge, no nation has ever been so ready to seize the burden and the glory of freedom. And in this high endeavor, may God watch over the United States of America.
While President Kennedy was a man who welcomed struggle, he was not the sort of man who believed that struggle was an excuse for totalitarianism and dictatorship. And he said this, too, in that same message.
It is our belief that the state is the servant of the citizen and not its master. This basic clash... this basic clash of ideas and wills is but one of the forces reshaping our globe. Swept as it is by the tides of hope and fear, by crises in the headlines today that become mere footnotes tomorrow. Both the successes and the setbacks of the past year remain on our agenda of unfinished business. For every apparent blessing contains the seeds of danger. Every area of trouble gives out a ray of hope. And the one unchangeable certainty is that nothing is certain or unchangeable. Yet our basic goal remains the same, a peaceful world community of free and independent states, free to choose their own future and their own system, so long as it does not threaten the freedom of others. Some may choose forms and ways that we would not choose for ourselves, but it is not for us that they are choosing. We can welcome diversity the communists cannot, for we offer a world of choice, and they offer a world of coercion. And the way of the past shows clearly that freedom, not coercion, is the wave of the future.
There was another struggle that President Kennedy welcomed, the struggle for supremacy in outer space, a far horizon, a wide horizon for the new frontier. First stop, Cape Canaveral, next stop, the moon. And an astronaut named Glenn is the first American ever to blast into orbit. The date, February 20th, 1962. Listen.
This is Mercury Control. The MA-6 launch countdown is T-minus 30 and counting, T-minus 30 seconds and counting.
This is the last human control. At any moment, the vernier should light. General Dynamics' Tom O'Malley starts the stamping motor.
The Mercury spacecraft umbilical is out. We're at T-minus 19 seconds.
The firing button
T-minus 10 seconds. Counting. 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2,
there
was
the ignition of the vernier.
0, ignition, liftoff. The MA-6 vehicle has lifted off. Trajectory looks good. The MA-6 vehicle has off the launch pad.
The spaceship Friendship 7 cut the Earth down to size, and the telephone spans sea as well as land, from White House to a man just returned from the wild blue yonder.
Hello?
Hello, sir?
Colonel? This is Colonel Glenn.
Oh, listen, Colonel, we're really proud of you, and I must say you did a wonderful job.
Thanks, Mr. President.
Well, we're glad you get down in very good shape. I was just watching your father and mother on television, and they seemed very happy.
Well, it was a wonderful trip. It's almost unbelievable to think back on it right now, but it was really tremendous.
Well, we're going to we'll see you over at... I'm going to come down to Canaveral on Friday, and then hope you come up to Washington on Monday or Tuesday, and I look forward to seeing you there.
Well, fine. I'll certainly look forward to it.
President Kennedy talking to Colonel Glenn, and now the president talks to the nation about another ocean.
I know that I expressed the great happiness and thanksgiving of all of us that Colonel Glenn has completed his trip, and I know that this is particularly felt by Mrs. Glenn and his two children. A few days ago, Colonel Glenn came to the White House and visited me. And he was, as are the other astronauts, the kind of American of whom we are most proud. Some years ago, as a Marine pilot, he raced the sun across this country and lost. And today, he won. I also want to say a word for all those who participated with Colonel Glenn at Canaveral. They faced many disappointments and delays. The burdens upon them were great, but they kept their heads and they made a judgment, and I think their judgment's been vindicated. We have a long way to go in the space race. We started late, but this is the new ocean, and I believe the United States must sail on it and be in a position second to none.
It was a welcome change for President Kennedy, talking not about another crisis, talking not about the risk we must face in the age of the bomb. It was a welcome change to talk to astronauts and to the nation and the world about our country's accomplishments in outer space. But in less than 2 months, on April 11, 1962, there was another crisis. This one, though, on the home front, and its name was steel. The issue, an unexpected price rise. The action? Listen.
The simultaneous and identical actions of United States Steel and other leading steel corporations increasing steel prices by some $6 a ton constitute a wholly unjustifiable and irresponsible defiance of the public interest. The Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission are examining the significance of this action in a free, competitive economy. The Department of Defense and other agencies are reviewing its impact on their policies of procurement. And I am informed that steps are underway by those members of the Congress who plan appropriate inquiries into how these price decisions are so quickly made and reached, and what legislative safeguards may be needed to protect the public interest. Price and wage decisions in this country, except for a very limited restrictions in the case of monopolies and national emergency strikes, are and ought to be freely and privately made. But the American people have a right to expect, in return for that freedom, a higher sense of business responsibility for the welfare of their country than has been shown in the last 2 days. Some time ago, I asked each American to consider what he would do for his country, and I asked the steel companies. In the last 24 hours, we had their answer.
That's what President Kennedy said, and this is what Roger M. Blau, the president of U.S. Steel, answered on the very next day.
When the president of the United States speaks, as he did yesterday, regarding our corporation and its cost price problems, I'm sure a response is indicated and desirable. Let me say respectfully that we have no wish to add to acrimony or to misunderstanding. We do not question the sincerity of anyone who disagrees with the action we have taken. Neither do we believe that anyone can properly assume that we are less deeply concerned with the welfare, the strength, and the vitality of this nation than are those who have criticized our action. As employees and stockholders, we, along with thousands of other employees and stockholders, both union and non-union, must discharge faithfully our responsibilities to United States Steel. But as citizens, we must also discharge fully our responsibilities to the nation. The action we have taken is designed to meet both those responsibilities.
Why so swift and so severe a crackdown? The President of the United States told why in a conversation with three network newscasters, NBC's Sander Vanocur among them, in a December 17th conversation.
I think it would have been a serious situation if I had not attempted with all my influence to try to get a rollback, because there was an issue of good faith involved. The steel union had accepted the most limited settlement that they had had since the end of the Second War. They had accepted it 3 or 4 months ahead. They did it in part, I think, because I said that we could not afford another inflationary spiral that would affect our competitive position abroad. So they signed up. And then when their last contract was signed, which was the Friday or Saturday before, then steel put its prices up immediately. Well, it seemed to me that that was a question of good faith was involved, and that if I had not attempted, after asking the unions to accept a non-inflationary settlement, if I hadn't attempted to use my influence to have the companies hold their prices stable, I think the unions could have rightfully felt that they had been misled. In my opinion, it would have endangered the whole bargaining between labor and management, would have made it impossible for us to exert any influence from the public point of view in the future on these great labor management disputes which do affect the public interest. So I have no regrets. The fact is, we were successful. Now, supposing we had tried and made a speech about it and then failed, I would have thought that would have been an awful setback to the office of the presidency.
Throughout his 2 years and 10 months as President of the United States, John Fitzgerald Kennedy showed his interest in the youth of America, in the youth of the world. He saw in them perhaps the hope of humanity, the hope that the word peace would mean just that, peace. Peace for all, peace everywhere, peace in the survival of man. Look back at his accomplishments while in office, and everywhere there is youth. Even on the White House lawn as he welcomes 2,000 foreign exchange students to the United States of America.
I want to welcome you to the White House. I'm afraid I had understood that we had 2,000 foreign students, but I'm afraid that your year's stay in the United States has made you at least on the surface look like 2,000 Americans. Whether that's a good thing or not, only time will tell. But we're glad to have you here.
But just as there was joy in welcoming the cream of the world's youth to America, so too there was sadness in honoring the memory of American men who lost their lives on foreign shores, men who made the supreme sacrifice so that all other men could remain free. The President salutes them in his State of the Union message on the 14th of January of the year that also marked his own violent death, 1963.
I think these are proud and memorable days in the cause of peace and freedom. We are proud, for example, of Major Rudolph Anderson, who gave his life over the island of Cuba. We salute Specialist James Allen Johnson, who died on the border of South Korea. We pay honor to Sergeant Gerald Pendle, who was killed in Vietnam. They are among the many who in this century, far from home, have died for our country. Our task now, and the task of all Americans, is to live up to their commitment.
In the first two-thirds of the year 1962, the nation moved along on an even keel, free of crisis, if you can accept such things as the Viet Cong in South Vietnam. Attention was focused mainly on domestic affairs, medical care for the aged, a farm bill, taxes, the budget, and a healthy economy. There were no crises to speak of in those first 8 or 9 months of 1962, but then, suddenly, swiftly, another crisis on the home front. This one on a college campus in Mississippi. An American named Meredith wanted to go to classes there, but it became necessary for the President of the United States to speak directly to the people of that state, Mississippi, and he said this.
You have a new opportunity to show that you are men of patriotism and integrity. For the most effective means of upholding the law is not the state policeman or the marshals or the National Guard. It is you. It lies in your courage to accept those laws with which you disagree, as well as those with which you agree. The eyes of the nation and all the world are upon you and upon all of us. And the honor of your university and state are in the balance. I am certain the great majority of the students will uphold that honor. There is, in short, no reason why the books on this case cannot now be quickly and quietly closed in the manner directed by the court. Let us preserve both the law and the peace. And then, healing those wounds that are within, we can turn to the greater crises that are without and stand united as one people in our pledge to man's freedom.
That was on September the 30th, 1962, a domestic crisis. But then it was October the 22nd, 1962, and there was a much broader crisis, a crisis that easily might have meant the end of all mankind. The buildup of Soviet missiles in Cuba, only 90 miles away from the United States shores and pointed at the heart of our country. But President Kennedy was up to this crisis too, very much up to it. So in spite of all the risk involved, he took 7 steps, the most important of which were these.
Acting therefore in the defense of our own security and of the entire Western Hemisphere and under the authority entrusted to me by the Constitution as endorsed by the resolution of the Congress, I have directed that the following initial steps be taken immediately. First, to halt this offensive buildup, a strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. All ships of any kind bound for Cuba, from whatever nation or port, will, if found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back. This quarantine will be extended if needed to other types of cargo and carriers. We are not at this time, however, denying the necessities of life, as the Soviets attempted to do in their Berlin blockade of 1948. Second, I have directed the continued and increased close surveillance of Cuba and its military buildup. The foreign ministers of the OAS, in their communique of October 6, rejected secrecy on such matters in this hemisphere. Should these offensive military preparations continue, thus increasing the threat to the hemisphere, further action will be justified. I have directed the armed forces to prepare for any eventualities. And I trust that in the interest of both the Cuban people and the Soviet technicians at the sites, the hazards to all concerned of continuing this threat will be recognized. Third, it shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union.
Yes, the President of the United States was up to what the world came to know as the Cuban Missile Crisis. And the chest of every American swelled with pride, because the voice of the man who had spoken the "we're ready to take the consequences" words was their spokesman, our spokesman, the voice of America, the conscience and courage of America. And then it was December, and just about the end of two crisis-riddled years in the presidency. And newsmen asked him what those 2 years had been like. What was his reaction?
I would say that the problems are more difficult than I imagined them to be. The responsibilities placed on the United States are greater than I imagined them to be. And there are greater limitations upon our ability to bring about a favorable result than I had imagined them to be. And I think that's probably true of anyone who becomes president, because there is such a difference between those who advise or speak or legislate and between the man who must select from the various alternatives proposed and say that this shall be the policy of the United States. Well, it's much easier to make the speeches than it is to finally make the judgments.
And then newsmen asked John F. Kennedy about the perils of nuclear war.
Once he fires his missiles, it's all over anyway, because we're going to have sufficient resources to fire back at him to destroy the Soviet Union. When that day comes and there's a massive exchange, then that's the end for, because you're talking about Western Europe, Soviet Union, the United States of 150 million fatalities in the first 18 hours. So that the nuclear age is a very dangerous period, and that's why I frequently read these speeches about how we must do this and that, but I think they ought to just look at what we're talking about.
Reporters got slightly less global in their questioning. They asked the president only about Berlin.
Berlin is a dangerous position always, particularly because of its geography, because we have to keep communications to an area which is 120 miles behind their lines. So this always gives him a chance to tighten the grip on our windpipe there. But I think he may proceed with some care, because I think he realizes it's the combination of a vital interest and one which has the chance of a direct encounter. So that I think that, as I say, Mr. Khrushchev's speech showed that he knows, and those who are attacking Mr. Khrushchev in the communist camp, particularly the Chinese, as being too soft, I think Mr. Khrushchev realizes the care with which he must proceed now, as do we.
The reporters weren't finished with their questions. They seldom are. They always have just one more to ask. Several years ago, while John F. Kennedy was still a senator, his father had asked him why he wanted to be the President of the United States. And he had replied quite matter-of-factly that he considered himself the best man for the job. And so now, at this roundtable conversation in December of 1962, a newsman asked him roughly the same question.
Yes, I think that the presidency, there's a lot of satisfactions to the presidency, because particularly, if, as I say, we're all concerned as citizens and as parents and all the rest with all the problems we've been talking about tonight. They're all the problems which, if I wasn't president, I'd be concerned about as a father or as a citizen. So at least you have an opportunity to do something about them. And if what you do is useful and successful, then of course that's great satisfaction. When, as a result of a decision of yours, a failure comes or you're unsuccessful, of course that's a great setback. But I must say, after being here for 2 years and having the experience of the presidency, and there's no experience you can get that can possibly prepare you adequately for the presidency, I must say that I have a good deal of hope for the United States, just because I think that this country, which is as I say, criticized itself and has criticized around the world 180 million people for 17 years, really for more than that, for almost 20 years, have been the great means of defending first the world against the Nazi threat and since then against the communist threat. And if it weren't for us, the communists would be dominant in the world today, and because of us, we're in a strong position. Now, I think that's a pretty good record for a country with 6% of the world's population, which is very reluctant to take on these burdens. I think we ought to be rather pleased with ourselves this Christmas.
And then it was January 14th, 1963, and President John Fitzgerald Kennedy delivered his third and final State of the Union message to the Congress of the United States and to all of its people, and also to all of the people of the world. And he spoke about the disarray of the left. He spoke about democracy versus communism.
New nations asked to choose between two competing systems. Need only compare conditions in East and West Germany, Eastern and Western Europe, North and South Vietnam. They need only compare the disillusionment of communist Cuba with the promise of a hemisphere alliance for progress. And all the world knows that no successful system builds a wall to keep its people in and freedom out. And the wall dividing Berlin is a symbol of that communist failure.
On the domestic scene, there was one accomplishment of President Kennedy's that stood out above all others, a home front accomplishment that will earn him a permanent place and an honorable place in the history of our nation. That accomplishment, of course, was in the field of human rights, the inalienable right of all Americans to be treated equally because they are equal, and no state and no governor can rule it otherwise. There were many presidents who came between Kennedy and Lincoln. 100 years is a long time. But John F. Kennedy did as much, did more, for the Negroes in his 2 years and 10 months of office than did all the other presidents combined. He did it, too, in the typically Kennedy manner, which stated simply is this: when action is called for, act, and when speech is called for, speak. Listen to him as he speaks on June the 11th, 1963. Soft but strong words brought on by the events in Alabama.
We are confronted primarily with a moral issue. It is as old as the scriptures and is as clear as the American Constitution. The heart of the question is whether all Americans are to be afforded equal rights and equal opportunities, whether we are going to treat our fellow Americans as we want to be treated. If an American, because his skin is dark, cannot eat lunch in a restaurant open to the public, if he cannot send his children to the best public school available, if he cannot vote for the public officials who represent him, if, in short, he cannot enjoy the full and free life which all of us want, then who among us would be content to have the color of his skin changed and stand in his place? Who among us would then be content with the counsels of patience and delay?
By the time the president made that speech, he had reached a spiritual point of no return. Earlier, during a speech at Vanderbilt University, Mr. Kennedy had endorsed the right of Negroes to defy local segregation laws. He had characterized it as being consistent with the highest traditions of American freedom.